At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding, whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Today I'm joined by Hope Virgo, Sharon White and Suzanne Samarka. Hope Virgo is an award-winning mental health campaigner and has been involved in several campaigns and projects to improve the support eating disorder patients receive. Sharon White, OBE, is the co-chair of the School Nurses International and the CEO of the School and Public Health Nurses Association, where she is a passionate advocate for children, young people and their families. Suzanne Samarka is a mental health campaigner and the founder of the Honesty About Editing campaign, which supports youth mental health against the challenges of low self-esteem and negative body image caused by edited content on social media. Hope, Sharon and Suzanne join me today to discuss the school nursing toolkit named Eating Disorders Can Affect Anybody, which aims to provide the latest evidence and research to inform best practice guidance for supporting a child, young person and their family with an eating disorder. To start with, we ask Hope Virgo what the new Eating Disorder Manifesto entails.
So the new Eating Disorder Manifesto is around trying to get the government to make a proper concrete commitment to tackling the epidemic of eating disorders. In the manifesto, we are calling on the government to invest in services to make sure that they can adequately meet the demand of those people struggling. It's about moving away from BMI and making sure that regardless of what weight you are, you can get that support. We're also calling on the government to invest into research. We know with eating disorders that they have the highest mortality rate out of any other psychiatric illness. We know that recovery is really, really difficult. And we also know that there's just not enough research out there to actually inform services and best practice. So we were calling on the government to invest properly into research and to make sure, again, that there is a commitment around doing that. With all of this, we need to have a time frame of implementation. We need to have a proper working group invested in to make sure that everyone is getting the right support when they need it.
Why has timely treatment been involved in the manifesto and why is it so important?
We know that early intervention is extremely important. Not only does it stop a person living with the illness for an extensive amount of time, but it also saves lives. We need to be making sure that actually we're having these conversations. We're hoping that not only does the school's toolkit begin to get in there early when people are struggling, but it's about society also getting in there. It's about making sure that we're not shying away from these conversations. As part of our launch of the school's toolkit, we're also launching a video with Instagram. And within that, hopefully, we're going to be offering a bit of insight in how you can have these conversations. Again, not shying away from them, listening, being patient, being direct. We talk so much these days about things like suicide and mental health more broadly. But yet with eating disorders, for some reason, we're still not having these conversations. We're still lagging behind, still fueling a lot of that shame and stigma, which is not allowing people to reach out for support. So we need as a society to make a commitment to be talking about these things, to think really practically about what we can do in our schools, in our workplaces and in our communities to make sure people are getting the right support.
Why did you decide to create the Eating Disorder School Kit, and are similar projects going to be done for adults and workplaces?
Schools are a really, really important place to be talking about eating disorders. We live in a society where we've completely normalised eating disorder culture. You walk around the playgrounds at school or sit in a canteen and there's kids left, right and centre talking about dieting, commenting on what each other are having, managing their calories. I spend a huge amount of time in schools working with young people and pretty much every single child has these calorie counting apps, which is just not normal. It's just not okay that we have created a society where disordered eating is just okay. That's why we are launching this toolkit. We want to get in there early with young people to ensure that people can get the support they need. But we need to make sure that people realise that also adults get affected. For too long, the shame and stigma has stopped adults reaching out. There's this whole narrative that to have an eating disorder, you have to be a child or you'll eventually grow out of having an eating disorder. But more and more research is coming out at the moment showing that people actually develop eating disorders in adulthood. But also, we all know that you don't just grow out of an eating disorder. I've had an eating disorder since I was 12 years old. I'm now 32. And yes, I'm in a very good space in my recovery. But I didn't get this miraculous fix when I turned 18. That's just not how these illnesses work. We don't choose to be that way, but it's just what happens. That's why it's really, really important through the work that we're doing, but also looking broadly, that we're remembering adults in this conversation. As part of the manifesto, we are making sure that actually adults get the same funding as children get, making sure that that funding is also ring-fenced, putting that pressure. And the amount of meetings I've gone to recently at number 10, where I've literally had to be like, don't forget adults, it still seems like they're being forgotten off the agenda. So we must keep talking about it. We must make sure that actually we're bringing them into these conversations. Whilst we know that prevention and awareness work is so, so important, and it is, it's key to getting society to talk about eating disorders and to change the narrative that we have created around them, and also to fight the shame and stigma that so many people fail. But it doesn't stop there. We need to ensure that the government are being held account to actually tackling this epidemic. We need to be making sure that people are getting the right support in the timely manner. No one should be dying of an eating disorder ever. But in 2022, the fact that this is still happening and it is not a complete and utter public outcry or national scandal is just not okay. We need to do better. That's why, as part of this work, we are launching a manifesto to put more pressure on the government to tackle this. So what can you guys do when you're like trying to support this is to talk about it, to keep raising awareness of eating disorders, to contact your local MPs, to make sure that they're not shying away from these conversations. For too long, the government have hidden behind the global pandemic or blamed social media for causing this increase in eating disorders. But actually, it goes much deeper than all of this. Eating disorders are a very serious mental health issue, and it's time that as a society, we stand up and we treat them like this. I would really, really encourage you after listening to the podcast today to head over to the Dump the Scales campaign, where you can find example letters that you can then forward on to your MPs, asking them what they are doing to support those people with eating disorders. The only way that we can change this and to make sure the government take this seriously is to make as much noise as possible. You can also see a little bit more about the campaigning work and the toolkit over on my Instagram, which is hopevirgo_.
And then we spoke to Suzanne and Sharon about the Creating the Eating Disorder Toolkit.
Hello, Suzanne and Sharon.
Hi, good morning. Hiya, Hannah.
How are you both doing?
Very well,
yeah, pretty
thank
good,
you.
I think. Not bad for a grey Wednesday morning in Yorkshire.
That's when you know you're a southerner, because the sun's definitely out today. It's a day for getting the washing on the line, especially in October.
I did debate putting my washing out, but it's so windy that I'm terrified everything's going to get blown away.
Yeah, there is that.
Mine's currently in the tumble dryer.
Oh, I don't have a tumble dryer. I've not got that luxury.
And it'll probably have to go given the fuel crisis. So I'll enjoy the luxury while I've got it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you both so much for joining me today. I'm very excited to discuss the project that you've been working on, and perfectly timed that when this episode comes out, it will have all been released. So that's really great. So I wondered if you wanted to start, and we'll kind of, I'm just going to shoot the questions at you and you can kind of decide between you who wants to answer it. But what does the new eating disorder manifesto that you've been working on with Hope, what does that outline?
Sharon, do you want to take that? Give that over the...
So as you've already mentioned, Hope is an internationally renowned actually mental health activist and fabulous ambassador for children and young people and adults, mental health and well-being, but also an expert by experience in terms of eating disorders. And so under her amazing leadership and guidance, we have come together to support her campaign. And what we at SAFNA have specifically been working on is the development of the toolkit you've already alluded to, Hannah. But also one of the unintended but great outputs as well that's happened in that work is a resource for schools, because when we pulled together the project, the advisory board to the project, quite overwhelmed by the number of young people, whether they be have undergone an eating disorder, in an eating disorder, are in recovery, whether it be their friends or their siblings came forward, as did parents, carers and professionals. And through the work and exploration and experiences so freely and honestly shared by the most amazing human beings, we've managed as part of this campaign to produce the Eating Disorders Toolkit and a resource for schools, so that we're supporting our education colleagues to support children, young people, their friends, their siblings, their families, at the same time as supporting school nurses. And that we've got a shared narrative, that we're saying the same things, that we're on the same page. And the evidence and research, critically, includes local intelligence from the children, the young people, the families, the carers, the siblings. So it may not look very academic in terms of evidence and research, though it is underpinned with evidence and research, obviously. But actually, without wanting to denigrate and use this term, it is from the horse's mouth, and there's nothing more valuable. I think often when we work with children, young people, and indeed adults around mental health issues, we do unto rather than with. And certainly in school nursing, we talk about co-production, but actually how real that is and how honest, and it's scary, to be honest, to ask children and young people and families what they want. But you can't always deliver on it, but actually really drilling down, taking that professional risk, getting into that professional curious conversation is what we've been able to do here. So our contribution to the wider campaign that Hope is leading has certainly been on the School Nurse Toolkit and the educational resource.
Yeah.
Do you want to say any more about that, Suzanne?
Yeah, I think just to add to that, I mean, so I have a family member that's gone through a number of years of an eating disorder, and they're not my child, so I'm a carer rather than a direct parent. And I think what's been really important with this project is, like Sharon says, it's come from the horse's mouth, and they've really taken into account not just lived experience, which is so, so valid, but also that of carers, parents, professionals, teachers who, you know, teachers aren't trained to be eating disorder specialists. So when it does come up, they're as terrified by it as we are as parents. And you know, parents and carers, we went through an experience that we never expected to go through. And to be honest, when it first started, we were absolutely terrified by it, because you realise you know absolutely nothing. And whether you like it or not, it does still carry a lot of stigma. And as a parent or a carer, it comes with a lot of guilt and a lot of shame, and it shouldn't do, absolutely shouldn't do. And the more we talk about these things and provide resources that are helpful for not just professionals, but like Sharon said, friends or teachers or parents or anybody that's touched by something that is this complex to understand, because as a person that has had experience of this being in our family, you do feel like completely lost. It's such a mind-blowing experience and changes everything that you thought you knew. It's almost like the ground goes from under you. So it's that's what's been really important for me, that actually it's taken in a wide range of different values and different understandings and beliefs into the project.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. Kind of, you know, we're definitely moving towards a place where lived experience is brought into services and stuff like that. But like you say, getting the kind of, you know, the needs and the experience of everybody around them as well, because everybody does play a part. You know, eating disorders don't just kind of affect the person that's struggling with it, it affects everybody around it. And I think I really like that you've gone to teachers and school nurses as well as, you know, the direct parents or carers, because I think whilst I do, you know, I'm so glad that you're doing this, and I think that the training definitely should be in place for teachers and everybody else, it's kind of, to me, it should be something that teachers get, but you don't necessarily get parents, let's say, going along to training about when your child gets an eating disorder, because you don't get training for anything really, do you, when you're a parent? So actually to understand what everybody needs feels so important. And when you, maybe Suzanne, you could talk about it, kind of what you explained that you felt, and also maybe looking at the wider picture of what other people felt was important. What were the things that came up that people really wanted within the resources for, you know, supporting someone with an eating disorder?
So I think the big aspect that needed to be in there was just to reiterate that, because a big part of it was for school nurses and how to potentially speak to parents or carers, and also take into account there might be siblings in the same school and the effect on them as well, because it has a huge effect on them. And I know as a family, we were extremely defensive when this first came to our family. Because we felt like we'd failed. That's the bottom line. And I think anybody that's then talking to parents or carers or anybody involved, you haven't failed. The person hasn't failed. You know, it's nobody's fault. And collaboratively, they can recover from this. And it's a case of talking is such an undervalued process, whether it be talking to somebody who is a friend or somebody who's a stranger, to be honest, but talking and getting it out of your head, because what your head tells you, whether that be the person suffering or the parent or whoever it be, if you're not talking about it, it creates loneliness. And that loneliness, dealing with your own head and your own thoughts, can be such an awful place. But actually, if we're all striving for the same goal. So if you're all talking to each other and being, you know, mindful of everyone's experiences and emotions at a point in time, that emotions are hugely raised at this point in time, we can all achieve the same goal. And that's the caring for the people that are suffering.
You're absolutely right, Suzanne, that was very clear from the carers and parents and indeed the young people. And I said earlier, we call it a shared narrative and we call it health literacy, and you can badge it whatever you want to. But actually, we've got something in school nursing. When we were looking at what was needed from school nurses, somebody called it professional reluctance to be outspoken. And when we tried to kind of understand that, there's a professional respect that you don't want to upset parents, you don't want to upset the child. If you talk to school teachers, they'll say the same thing. How do you begin to broker that really difficult conversation? You know, how do you become unpopular with that parent? How do you incur the wrath of an angry, defensible parent who says, how dare you? say my child might have an eating disorder. How do you, as a school nurse, become unpopular by asking the difficult questions of the young person and then talking to school and then talking to parents within confidential structures? So you're absolutely right, Suzanne, that the main ask from parents and carers and the support networks around children and young people was, can we just get this out there, and how do we do that as well as we possibly can? And within the resources, there's some cracking examples that have come from the experts to help us with those difficult conversations. And that's what I mean about when I think some of our externals who might look at it might think, oh, research evidence-based, actually experts by experience is part of our research and evidence, that it doesn't fit in an academic framework often, but actually this is the real richness and this is what will make the difference. Mm. So I think we had a quote, and I may misquote it, and correct me, Suzanne, about a teacher calling a parent to say, I'm a little bit concerned about your daughter or son, or I've noticed she's looking a little bit different, or, and I think one of the parents said that was how it was brokered with them. And the parent was so blinking relieved that school had also spotted the signs, yes, spoke to the parent, and then facilitated the parent to have that really difficult open conversation with school. That must have been really difficult, but actually was triggered by that professional confidence of a teacher being professionally curious enough to say, actually, I'm a little bit concerned about your son or daughter. So I think you're right, Suzanne, it's invaluable, that part of the resources.
And I think just to add to that as well, I think often as parents and carers, we might see what we don't want to see. We do see it, and actually by then, like you say, somebody in a professional capacity, whether that be a teacher or a school nurse, to share those concerns in the right way and also then have the support of how to do that, helps us as parents, because it is the last thing you probably want to admit. See, you might have had concerns, but you don't really, well, from my experience, we had no idea what happens next. So you don't really know what it means. So I think it's helpful for parents, and it's helpful for teachers and all of the school network as well.
Yeah. I think the idea of kind of providing that resource on communication, that to me stood out as something really poignant, because I think a lot of the time, you know, whether it's a parent, carer, teacher, school nurse, anybody, a lot of the time, you mentioned the stigma kind of associated with eating disorders, Suzanne, and I think a lot of the time there is so much stigma that people are almost terrified to say anything, so they don't say anything. And, you know, as you've just explained there, if someone's spotted that something might not be quite right, I would say that, you know, they have a position there to say, you know, how's everything going or whatever. But I wanted to ask you, maybe to be a bit controversial, because it sounds like a wonderful situation where a school nurse spots something from their training and reaches out to a parent and says, you know, a bit worried, and the parent says, oh, yes, same, like, thank you so much. How do you think it should be navigated if, because I can imagine that a lot of parents, you know, because of that stigma, because of that shame, often parents thinking that they're being blamed. If a parent was called, you know, and they became quite defensive, I did a podcast a few weeks ago with a teacher, and she was, you know, saying, I'm not really sure where my response, well, she knew where her responsibility sat in kind of saying, I'm worried about your child. But, you know, actually, if the parent is dismissive of that, or kind of says, you know, nothing's wrong, where do you go with that as a professional? Because you're going to want to help, but, you know, what's the line?
Yeah, and that came up, and we've tried to address that as best we can, Hannah. Mm-hmm. And it's not new for school nurses, this. It's not just about eating disorders. There are many issues that children, young people come to share with us, or that the teachers refer to us, or we get involved in, where it might be controversial or difficult to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So school nurses are trained in having those difficult conversations with parents, but sometimes, you know, we have to accept that perhaps right now, in this place, in this time, it's not the right time for this parent. Now, if we felt the child was any significant risk to harm, so depending on the state they are in, physically, emotionally, mentally, socially, we may have to go beyond the parent and perhaps make a referral to social care, for example. So if it was loosely couched in safeguarding, if we felt that child was at risk or posed a risk to anybody else, then we would use our processes to do that. However, in this situation and in all situations, we should be working in partnership with parents as much as we possibly can. So we would keep trying. We wouldn't just three strikes and you're out here. We would use all means available to us. So we'd try and have that conversation. If it wasn't received positively, perhaps we'd follow it up in a different medium. So maybe if the parents are accessing our text services, that might be less imposing. It might feel less threatening. Or we might use snail mail, go back to a letter, because that gives the parent time to reflect and think, digest, have a wonder about what might be best. And often, you know, as a health professional, I think nurses are, you know, they're still seen as the most trusted workforce by our country. But actually, we also can be very threatening to parents, particularly when you don't want to hear bad news about your child. Or it might come as the hugest shock, as Suzanne was talking about, that she had no idea what was going on. So I think as school nurses and highly trained skilled professionals, we've got a number of things at our disposal that we need to try and need to use. And sometimes, you know, we have to accept there are cases all the time where parents refuse to allow us to have that conversation back with the child or don't want any input. And if there are no safeguarding risks, then what we would do is try and work with others that are connected to that child. So support school or youth workers or friends. So we would do it in a less direct way. So we'd still facilitate the information sharing, the signposting, the advocacy, you know, we'd try and use other means to getting that support to the parent. So drip feeding, some might call it emotional blackmail, but I think professionally it's called using all methods available to us to try and engage and build up that trusting relationship with the parent. Because as Suzanne has outlined, for all kinds of reasons, it might be a past experience, it might be a personal or a professional experience, it might be just complete and utter shock, denial, a lack of understanding, maybe literacy. You know, are we talking to the parent in a way that they understand, in a language they know? Are we on the right level? Do we need to change how we are communicating? So there's a whole raft of things, Hannah. So that's a very long-winded response to your question. But sometimes we do have to accept that parents have a right providing. So once the child is over the age of 12, and I don't want to get embroiled in confidentiality, a child can self-consent. But we would only use that if, again, within certain given parameters. We would always aim, and particularly around something like eating disorders, where it needs full family cooperation and full school cooperation and school nurse cooperation. We need to at least triangulate our efforts to get the best outcomes for the child or young person.
I think you made a really good point there as well, Sharon, around time. So especially for parents, I think being told something and your reaction might be one way, and then you might go home and sit on that for a week and it won't leave your head for that week, and how you then deal with it, or how you're then approached again by support services or school nurse services, will land very differently perhaps to the first time. So it's absolutely around time and where that person might be in that journey of acceptance, if you like.
You're absolutely right, Suzanne. I think, you know, we talk about working with young people where they're at. And I think we also need to do that with parents and carers. You know, I've been at the receiving end of a phone call from a health professional about one of my children. I was absolutely incandescent with rage for all kinds of reasons. But actually, when I had time to reflect, it was more about me having not seen that in my child. It was nothing to do with the person portraying the information. It was, how the heck did I miss that? And it, all my emotions were around my response to that. And when I try to unpick it, like you say, Suzanne, when you sit and try and reflect and assimilate what's being said about the child in your care, you know, there are a number of outputs, but for most parents, once they've had that time, they're very grateful to come back and say, okay, I hear you. What can we do?
Yeah, definitely. I kind of want to ask what, from, you know, the research that you've been doing and stuff, where you sort of saw the school nurse's role, because, you know, it sounds, there's a big picture here, you know, you've got the identification, potentially speaking to the parents, supporting the parents, supporting the child, you know, is that something that is going to be expected or is expected? Or, because that feels like a lot to take on, but I also think, you know, then maybe signpost into services and stuff, but services are overworked. So have you thought about how it's all going to fit in together to make sure that the person's getting the right support?
We have, Hannah, and I will just name the elephant in the room, that we've had a disinvestment and lost over 30% of the school nursing workforce in the past 5 years. And the workforce in nursing is hemorrhaging. Yeah. We're seeing the same in school nursing too. But let's just let's clarify a few things. So this toolkit is for all nurses working with school-age children in schools. So we have lots of nurses based in independent schools. Mm-hmm. Then we have what I call the state school nurse, those employed by the local authority, based in community settings and covering a raft of schools. So one school nurse may have 3 high schools and 10 primary schools to cover. Yeah, so that's, she's underpinned by, so a qualified school nurse, which our independent school nursing colleagues may not be, but would be registered nurses. A qualified school nurse is postgrad and often at master's level now. So she would lead the team, and then under that would sit staff nurses, nursery nurses, healthcare support workers and admin. So although she'd be the named nurse for all those schools, she wouldn't be expected to do all the work in those schools. So the role of the state school nurse, and it does cross over to our colleagues in independent schools too, is to prevent and protect. Mm-hmm. So the public health role is to do the health education, the health promotion, the prevention through all of that work. So healthy eating, healthy lifestyles, influencing the food policy at schools, working with the governing body, working with the school meals, looking at vending machines, having, you know, lovely healthy snacks for children available, access to water. So that would be like the framework of the school nurse's work. And then as the children progress through school, they should be seen at reception, year six, mid-teens and post-teens. There should be the 4 health needs assessments that are offered by state school nurses, where you would assess the child's health in partnership with the parents up to year six, and then just the young people after that, and work out what's going on. So it would be much more of a reactive service. You've got the preventative public health role, then you've got the reactive, but it could be at all kinds of levels. It could be if you've got a young person who's worried about their weight, and it might be that they're overweight or underweight. So you'd unpick that with them. For most of them, it would be guidance, advice, support, resources, signposting. For some of them, there'd be alarm bells ringing, okay? And that would require a different response. That would might require referral. It might require support around self-esteem, mental health issues, building trust and relationships to allow that young person to tell the full story. And then that would trigger a different response depending on the level. So if it was low-level concern, we're trained to a level where we could do those brief, we call it brief interventions and motivational interviewing in the trade, but would work at that lower level of mental health issues, offer support, advice, tools, would test out some tools to work with the young person. It could be a food diary, for example. It could be joining some activity or something. So we'd work at that low level. When we get to the medium level, we need to recognise our competencies and our specialist skills. And then we need to be looking to where else we could refer at that point. Now, you're absolutely right, Hannah, that, you know, some areas in the country for child and adolescent mental health services, the CAMHS, have a waiting list of a year to be assessed. But even when children are assessed now, we've got children waiting for a year to be seen. And we've got a very precarious situation at the moment where school nurses know they should not and will not act beyond their code of professional conduct. However, with their duty of candour as a registered nurse, they cannot abandon those children either. So we've got a huge potential bubbling issue here that is fragile and very concerning. I think for our school nurse colleagues in independent schools, they often have more time to have eyes on those children because they're based, whether they're the residents or not, they're based in the school. And we do have a growing number of schools, state schools, employing their own nurses as well. But if we talk about our colleagues in independent schools, so they have opportunity to be involved much more in the health education, health promotion curriculum. They have much more opportunity to be visible, accessible and confidential. So they can be around on the corridors. They can have state school nurses offer regular drop-ins, but, you know, they've got an open door in independent schools. I know our school nurse colleagues will complain about the queue, but they've got an open door. They often have a medical base where children will go for all kinds of little worries and niggles, but also, you know, real complex issues. So I think for our independent school nursing colleagues, they have more opportunity, in answer to your question, Hannah, to be visible, accessible and confidential. So the young person can spot you, work out you're a nurse, suss you out, test your trust, build up the confidence, talk to the mates, see what she said. Did she tell the mum? Did she tell school? Did she keep your secret? What did she do, you know, or he do? Were they worth the salt? Will they deliver on the goods? Will she just give me two paracetamol and send me away? Or is this person really good for me? They can do that much more when you've got a nurse based in school. And in the good old days, for state school nursing, you know, back in my day, I was in my schools once a week, if not three times a week. I'd be delivering sex education, I'd be delivering healthy eating, I'd be involved in the PSHE curriculum. So not only would the children, young people and families see me in the playground and see me given immunisations and see me in the dinner hall, they'd see me in the drop-in and they'd see me in assemblies, they'd see me in their classrooms. So I think that's where we need to get back to for state school nursing, and that's the advantage of our nursing colleagues who are based in schools. You're right, Hannah, it is a ridiculous ask, and I was looking at some numbers before I joined the podcast, and what school nurses are telling me is that over 80% of the young people that contact them, whether that be through a text messaging service, whether it be through whatever medium that is, over 80% of complex mental health issues. And post-COVID, we have a tsunami of safeguarding issues that are hitting us, that a lot of abuse and neglect happened during COVID to a lot of children. And only now are they feeling able to tell us their stories. So we've got huge exponential rise in safeguarding, a huge exponential rise in mental health issues, and they're manifesting in eating disorders, anxiety, depression, self-harm, you name it. So we are in a very treacherous position, I would say, as a society. The government would argue they've put a lot of investment into mental health for our children and young people. And to a point, that is true. And we can go on about the too little too late if we want, or we can build on what they're doing and try to influence and shape that according to needs. You're absolutely right, Hannah. A huge ask, a huge mountain to climb. However, we will skill up our education colleagues, skill up our school nurses so that we can at least recognise, advocate, support, and refer. So my glass is always half full, and we're doing a number of strategies around trying to increase the school nursing workforce, as you can imagine, as a professional organisation, but also using the new digital offer to exploit that and increase our visibility through all methods we can.
You just mentioned the digital aspect and the visibility, and I think, you know, in an ideal world, we would have a school nurse in every school 3 times a week. But the reality is that's not going to happen anytime soon, if ever again, to be honest.
Oh, I think it might, Suzanne. I'm always up for this challenge.
I'll go with your glass half full. But like you say, we have got so much more technology now. And the reality is that young people are, we were talking about it just before the podcast, Sharon, you know, we're technophobes at best, but young people aren't. And they're very, very comfortable using a tech service and an online service or speaking to some, they're more comfortable opening up in that sense as it stands. And actually, can we leverage that better to put people, maybe virtually, but in those schools, where they need to be, and use that smarter to be able to try and work against these rising numbers.
You're right, Suzanne. One word of caution, though, because some areas are seeing that as a cost-saving exercise for commissioning of services.
Yeah.
So we can replace school nursing with a bot or a tech service, which we can't. We can never replace the face-to-face, but what we can do is complement, supplement and offer a hybrid model. And you're absolutely right, Suzanne. So Chat Health are the main provider of tech services for school nursing. They grew exponentially during COVID because commissioners, providers realised we were not reaching our children, young people, particularly our most vulnerable. So what else could we do? There's been a massive growth in Chat Health, and I'm not particularly, I do support Chat Health, but there are others out there on the market as well. But you're absolutely right, Suzanne. Some of the learning, if you look at their impact report of young people coming forward, particularly young boys coming forward, often prefer to come faceless, just a text. And then if there is an appointment with a school nurse, virtually, they often turn the screen off.
Yeah.
There's anecdotal evidence beginning to arise, and we're hoping to get some funding for research, where some of our most vulnerable would often choose, or most needy, would choose screen off. Because actually talking to a blank screen rather than a professional is much less intimidating. So you're absolutely right, Suzanne. There's a lot of, we've just completed a project with Birmingham University and Oxford Brookes, which was more of a literature review and a survey to better understand the digital offer redesigned from school nursing. What do we need to keep? What do we need to embrace? What worked for the children, young people? What worked for the stakeholders? And what don't we need to do? So we're on a journey with that, but you're right. Right now, we've got lots of good evidence emerging. And we know this from our children, young people. You know, that's where they're at. So what? How do we, as school nurses, increase our visibility using the digital offer, which I think is one of the great things that came out of a global pandemic.
Yeah, I think the chat service that you said about is fantastic, because I think a lot of the time, you know, people say, oh, the generation nowadays, they're always on the phones and they only talk to each other through social media or whatever, which, yes, you can complain about and say that it's not good. But equally, I think the fact that there's been that grasp and now there's a service that aligns with that, that's incredible, because you can't expect somebody that, you know, if they do only socialize on their phone, they're not going to go to somebody in person and tell them about all their worries. So I think that, you know, that sounds a brilliant thing to me. I was just wondering, in terms of like educating maybe the children or the students, because I know personally for me, when I had my eating disorder, I was at secondary school, and the person I went to was my PSHE teacher, because she was the one that taught me about you know, she mentioned an eating disorder, so I thought, maybe she'll know. And then she passed me on to the school nurse. So it, within this, is there sort of a plan for teachers to be trained and to be providing education to the students as well?
Sure. I mean, we have referenced that in the resources. As you know, in these days, Hannah, you can't be prescriptive about what training teachers should have, but we have said they need to be trained. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very fine line, isn't it? You know, just as I couldn't teach maths, should we expect our maths teachers to teach kids about about sex and about eating disorders? So there's always that tension, but I think as part of the wider children's workforce, we have a responsibility to children and young people to know and understand about eating disorders, around sexuality, around healthy lifestyle. So it's a broad brush, isn't it? And I think the expectations placed on our school colleagues is huge. However, from a SACNA point of view, we're working much closer as a result of COVID with a lot of senior leadership teams, a lot of schools, because I think teachers are recognising much more that if our children are not mentally healthy, they will not achieve attend and attain. And if we don't fix that bit, we might as well not bother. And so we're working much closer across the children's workforce. That would go for social care, health education, the voluntary sector. But particularly from a SACNA point of view, we're working with many more schools and many more organisations that provide the education to schools, such as TES or EduCare or Creative Education or whoever that might be. Because there's been a beautiful recognition out of a very sad event that if our children are traumatised, as are we, as professionals, to whatever degree that might be, whether it be personally, professional, a combination of it, all of us have been touched by a global pandemic in some way, that actually, how do we all help make that better? We're in the same situation. So there's, Our school staff do have an expectation to be trained and skilled. And one of the things the government has done is fund senior mental health leads in all high schools. So they've funded a senior mental health lead. Now, that's probably landed on the shoulders of the head of PSHE, who's also the DES teacher for looked after kids, for young carers, for safeguarding. However, that aside, there is funding and some fabulous providers delivering that training to our senior mental health leads in schools so that they can then be the expert across a high school, and then they can lead on whatever strategies they want to employ in that school. And then that would be the go-to person for teachers. So the senior mental health lead, as I see it, would have responsibility for working out what's in the curriculum around mental health. What do we need to add? What do we need to change? And there is within the resources some do's and don'ts. So I think it was one of the parents might have said, or might have been Hope that said, a lot of schools will put posters up to say, if you run up these stairs, you'll burn off so many calories. Well, can we not put posters up? Because if we want a mentally healthy school culture and a mentally healthy school, that perhaps is not the best for all the students. And I don't know how you would have felt, Hannah, if that was glaring you in the face. As somebody struggling with eating issues, actually, can I burn off calories running up and down these stairs 10 times? It might have been a good thing, it might have been a bad thing, but actually it's not a healthy thing. So we've got senior mental health leads. There is talk of funding for a counsellor also to be funded and based in schools. And then we have the rollout of the mental health support teams. So there would be the conduit between school nurses and CAMHS, and mental health support teams. A key role is training up our education colleagues. So there are structures and funding in place. I mean, I have a whole issue with why we created a mental health support team when actually school nurses are already providing that, but we won't get into that political debate at the moment. However, there are positive moves afoot. Unfortunately, we've got huge demand outstripping supply at the minute. And I'm not terribly sure what the answer is, but as I've said, I feel we're in quite a treacherous place. So the more we can do together with children, young people, parents, carers, schools and ourselves, the better outcome outcomes and outputs we're going to get, whatever they might be, for our children, young people.
I think you mentioned a really key point there, Sharon, that it's, as I see it, it's not the responsibility of just a school nurse or of just a teacher or the mental health lead or the parents. Everyone's always goes, well, that's the parents' job or teacher's job. Or actually, it's all of us. We've all got to take responsibility and we've all got to collaboratively work together to support people and the numbers of people, like you say, growing numbers of people who need the support. And in my view, and why I've put myself forward for this project, was prevention's better than the cure. If we can put things in place that help one person, then by my view, that was well worth my time. And that's, I think that's the approach we've got to take. It's not a blame game, whether it be teachers, school nurses, government. And it's very easy to, you know, say, well, the government should be doing more. You know, whether they should or shouldn't isn't the question. I think we've all just got to do what we can and work together.
I think you're right, Suzanne. And when working together, the safeguarding document first came out, we had a beautiful framework in it called Team Around the Child. And I think it's the most latest political speak is Think Family. But without diminishing that, what we know and understand better now is each one of us has got a role to play around that child or young person, distinct, but also the same.
Yeah.
And the shared narrative is one of the clear outputs of these resources. But also, in terms of Think Family, I don't know what your drivers were, Hannah, and I don't know what Suzanne's young person's drivers were for having an eating disorder, but somebody needs to understand what's going on in that household, not a blame situation.
Yeah.
So whether it be the school nurse or the teacher who does that assessment or social care or whoever, because often there are other pressures in the household, but often there are great assets in the household too. So we take an asset-based approach in health. Sorry, I'm talking a load of jargon, but I'm trying to make sense of it. So if a school nurse was allowed or invited by the parents and carers to your house, for example, Hannah or Suzanne, and sat with the carers and the young person and brokered that very difficult, challenging, emotional conversation to get the cards on the table using all their skills, then what's going on in that household? You know, have we had a bereavement? Have we had a separation? Have we had a loss? Have we had a redundancy? Have we lost our home? Has somebody been ill? Are you a young carer? Or actually, is this out of the blue? Is this around the young person's self-esteem? Is this around access to the internet? Is this around TikTok? And just look at Molly's case in the news this week and the dreadful outcome. And obviously Arthur as well, and Albert, sorry, as well. But, you know, what is going on for that young person? Recently, I heard from a school nurse where she conducted an electronic health needs assessment with year sixes. The young people completed information around their health in the classroom, with the school nurse in the classroom talking to them, and it inputted it onto an electronic system, and then it was analysed. And out of 22 children in that classroom, we had 7 children who created a bulimia club. They were 10-year-old. Yes, so I can see, obviously this is a podcast, so people can't see your reactions. That's quite staggering, but it's not unusual. So where are the young people getting the information from? How can we guide them through accessing that information? What is happening at home? It turned out in this group of young children, and these are their words, they were from yummy mummies who spent a lot of time exercising, a lot of time perhaps not eating as healthily as they might, and they were role modelling that to their girls. The girls didn't actually realise what they were doing was wrong. So what is the asset in that household? Well, actually, the asset is mum in that household. How do we help mum to recognise her impact on the child? But also, does mum want to change? She might not, but how do we help her you know, and because mommy is interested in her body image and because she's interested in a healthy lifestyle, whether that be positive or negative, it's still an asset. Does that make sense? So we need to understand what's going on for that child in the context. But you're right, Suzanne, that you know, I call it a triangle. It might actually be a diamond or a star, but whatever it is about prevention. It is about getting back to education, health promotion, health literacy, or whatever jargon is trendy. But also, here's the early spotting of the signs. Here's what you can do at this lower level. I'm not minimising low level. Here's what we can do. Here's what we shouldn't do. Here's what we could do. And here's what we do if it goes up a little bit further. So what assets have I got as a teacher, as a school nurse, as a parent, as a carer, as a young person? How do I self-help myself? Don't want to self-help myself. Okay, how can we help you? So you're absolutely right, Suzanne. This is nobody's one responsibility. It's a shared responsibility. And it's a shared fear as well. I don't know if you remember Jerry saying, so Jerry's our expert school nurse leading on this for us, Hannah, from SAFNA. And she said in her scoping, she did a word cloud, and at the centre of the word cloud from school nurses was terrified. They were terrified as professionals, even though they're highly skilled and highly trained, terrified of having a conversation, terrified of ruining relationships, terrified of the fallout for the family and the young person, terrified of the fallout from school. So, you know, we're all terrified together. And when you're terrified together, what happens is you reduce the terror.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's brilliant that they were able to, you know, do those assessments and stuff. But, you know, that is scary, age 10, kind of have that understanding. But I think it's so important what you said. And, you know, I think this goes back to any sort of treatment in general, they say patient-centered, but you know, here I don't know what we would say, but it does, the approach needs to be a patient-centered approach, because my household could be completely different to, let's say, my best friends at school.
Sure.
But my best friend's household could then be influencing on me. So you really have to get deep into understanding all of that. And I think at the moment we've just got an approach within treatment that's very sort of, you tick those boxes, so we'll give you this. But actually, you know, understanding that, and it, again, this is all fantastic and it's so amazing and it sounds like there's all that awareness there, but it takes time. It's not something that can just be a quick fix. And, you know, I think that's maybe what I'm taking away from this, is that, you know, the ideas are so brilliant and everything, but the resources, we need help to get more people, more resources, more time, more funding. And that's why I'm so grateful for all of your work on this manifesto to really, you know, outline all of that, because you really need everybody's experience to come together to say this is actually what's going on. Because, you know, the government have 1,001 things to deal with, which, you know, must be a difficult thing. I think if you can give them that information and say this is what's going on, like this is why we need the help, it's incredible that you've been able to put this together.
There is a good amount of interest in the parliamentary launch, isn't there, Suzanne? Numbers are going up. There is a good amount of interest from MPs, and Hope has been amazing at working at that policy level and bringing those people together. And I think we've got some potential change makers in the room, and some that are very vested in the work already, that they've worked with Hope for a long time, whether that because of personal reasons, professional reasons, or a combination of both, or come from the constituents, who knows. But that's what's very exciting about the parliamentary launch. And we've got good media interest as well, which is fantastic. And I did get a sneak preview of a video that's part of the campaign as well. It is powerful, and it's got some very high profile celebrities, for want of a better word, but also sports people who are right behind this manifesto and campaign, either because of personal or professional reasons. And I think that gives that very clear messaging as part of the wider manifesto, but also to children and young people who may be struggling to find their voice and tell their story, that actually if she's on there and she's saying this, that's okay. So, yeah, it's not going to be without its challenges, Hannah, but I do think we're very positive, and, you know, we can't change the world. It is treacherous for our young people at the minute. But if we pool our resources, there's always just a little bit more that can be given. Yeah. But, you know, it there's no simple answer, but this will help us.
I think it's amazing that you've got such a backing. That sounds brilliant. I was just, when you said there about celebrities and stuff, I remember distinctly when I was younger, Demi Lovato spoke about her eating disorder. Yes. And that gave me the confidence to go and say to my mum, you know, I think that there's an issue. And she was, you know, thinking there was an issue as well. But yeah, actually to hear somebody else say it, you think, wow, I can, you know, I can maybe actually do this. And also, you know, social media is something that our children and young people use so much. So getting it on social media and, you know, putting it on a platform that they will be able to access really will hopefully help.
I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to say, but Hope is working with one of the major social media platforms, and the video is being produced in partnership with them.
Wow.
So she's, yeah, recognising where our young people access most of their information. We're trying to balance that, and Hope has done an amazing job in negotiation with one of the major social media platforms. So hopefully there'll be a massive ripple effect from that. I don't know if you remember, you might be too young, but Jade Goody that died from cervical cancer.
Yep.
And we were just launching the HPV vaccination program. And I've spent a lot of time, I've had a lot of national leaders in this country working out workforce and systems and processes based on usual uptake of immunisations, and it went up 75% when she died. That is the impact that we can have with somebody that young people and children respect and know.
Yeah.
So whilst it's not the panacea, and you've got to be careful what you ask for, because that sent us all into a tiz of how we were going to deliver on this. But, you know, so we may open up another can of worms, but let's get the dialogue going.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a really key thing, I think. The more we talk about it, the more schools talk about it, parents talk about it, children, young people talk about it, celebrities, that's what removes the stigma and makes it easier for everyone involved.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one thing I've definitely noticed, and maybe I was being naive in a little cave, but is just the amount of people that are touched by eating disorders. You know, I think when I was poorly with mine like 10, 11 years ago, and it wasn't something that was, you know, not many people spoke about. But now if you mention the word, someone's like, oh, yeah, I know someone or what have you.
True.
Yeah. So the fact that, you know, so many people are getting involved, I'm not surprised, you know, sadly, I'm not surprised, but also I think it's, you know, it's a really good move forward for so many people to be coming and talking about their experiences.
I think just to add to that, actually, I mean, myself and my partner, we both work for a bank, so we're not in social change or teaching or nursing or anything like that. We're in the commercial world, and my partner quite often will talk about it now because we've had 5 years or so coming to terms with the experience. And he's sadly not amazed, but still slightly amazed that how many people will say to him, oh yeah, my daughter, son, whoever it be, when it comes up in conversation, and he goes and sees clients or talks to people and they say, yeah, they've been suffering with, and he'll always say, it's amazing how many people are affected by it, but nobody talks about it. So that's hopefully what we can combat.
Yeah, definitely. And I do think as well, you know, obviously the work you're doing in schools is absolutely amazing. I think the workplace is also a place that needs to be worked on in terms of speaking more openly about this sort of thing, because, you know, I had to take time off work for it, and it was horrible. Like, I didn't want to tell anybody, and that's as somebody that is so public on social media doing this podcast. And I thought, if I can't, and I am so articulate with, you know, saying it now, because I say it every week on this podcast, what is everybody else going through? But workplace almost breeds the diet culture, I think, worse than anywhere else in society. So, you know, you mentioned that you work in a bank, but I think equally, that's such an important place still to be having these conversations and to be making sure the support's in place for people, because I think a school, you know, you would hope that you can go to school nurse and get help, a workplace. I don't really know who you would go to.
I mean, funny enough, you mentioned it, and it's something I was going to speak to Sharon about. So this is something I haven't spoken to you yet about, Sharon, but we have in my company Working Families Network, and that talks about all sorts of things. And when I started the Honesty About Editing campaign, and I did a talk there about the campaign, and again, I got emails from parents saying my son, daughter's suffering, you know, and again, it's something where those parents feel they haven't got anywhere to go. Mm. So the toolkit, not the nurse's toolkit, but the toolkit that we've made for teachers and other people. Is that something we can share with corporates if they have got a family network, something like that? Because actually it is a resource where it can be helpful, or at least help signpost to the right resources and so on.
I can't see why not, Suzanne, because we're trying to reach as many people as possible, and it's going to be posted on the SAFNA website. And all we're going to ask people is just to complete a little bit of demographic confidential information and then do a bit of evaluation for us. So there's going to be free access. And if it touches children, young people and families and schools, then absolutely. And I know Hope's got a number of ideas for building on this work to reach into more into the adult population, Hannah, as well.
Brilliant.
And I also know that Hope does a lot of training with organisations in the commercial sector. And she does lunch and learns with this very large social media provider as well for their staff. So she already does. She does a lot of training and education in schools, colleges, universities with children, young people, families and staff. But also she does work in the commercial industry. Mm. So it'd be worth a conversation with her to see where that's accessible or how you contact and find out about it. But yes, Suzanne, from my point of view, and I don't think Hope would object at all, the more we push the resource out, promote it, advertise it, and Hannah, thank you for doing this podcast to support that, then the better.
Yeah, no, it's honestly my pleasure. When Suzanne emailed me, I really wanted to be able to kind of give you this platform and share it and get involved in any way I can, because I think it's such important work. Obviously today, in the future, when this is released, will be sort of the day that the manifesto is also released. So is there somewhere that people can keep updated with it, or, you know, follow it? Is it best to just follow you guys on social media, or how can they do that?
Yeah, sure. I think Hope's got a bit of a comms campaign going, so probably contact Hope, but we're part of that.
Yeah.
We're on all social media platforms, but Twitter is our main one, so okay. I'm at Safna Sharon OBE, and the reason the OBE is on the end is, yes, I did get an OBE, but actually if you Google the other at Safna Sharon, you get something completely different, which we don't want people to access. So at Safna Sharon OBE or at Safna team will be part of that comms, but Hope has got a whole comms strategy that she'll be able to tell you about.
I'm definitely going to have to Google what Safna Sharon OBE comes up with. If
No.
Maybe I won't then.
No, Safna Sharon OBE is okay. It's the it's the one without the OBE on the end.
Right. Okay. Okay. Well, I'm sure I can just sense everybody Googling that now. But thank you both so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having us. Thanks very much,
Hannah. Thank you for being open and honest as well, Hannah, around your own experiences. It really reaffirms what you're doing, particularly when you're weary with deadlines. So thank you for rebooting me again.
No worries.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.